Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Miles Podcast. Once again, we're doing some more informational episodes to kind of help us understand the process as well, along with men's experiences. So today I am welcoming Elise the Embryologist. So has definitely a really great presence on Instagram and has really a lot of neat videos and content. And I'm really excited to have her on to look at the side that a lot of us don't get to see. So welcome, Elise.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. I'm super excited. I know the male side of infertility is not talked about quite as much. And, you know, I appreciate you spending the time to highlight that side because it's really important. So it's great. I'm excited to be here.
Yeah, it's definitely a couple's issue for sure. And yeah, just highlighting what the male experience is.
Absolutely. So,
one question that I actually did not put on there, but I'm curious about how people learn about infertility, like in general. So how did you first learn about infertility?
Honestly, I did not know a lot about infertility until I got into the field. It's not something that's really talked about often, at least in my schooling. It wasn't something that was talked about. And I didn't really have a lot of family members who experienced it. And if they did, they weren't super open about their experience. So it was really something that I didn't have a lot of experience with until I got into the field. So I learned a lot on the job. Pretty much everything that I post and talk about, I've learned through experience, which I do think it's something that we need to do a little bit better about in terms of education, starting younger. Not necessarily that everyone is going to struggle with infertility. I just think it's something that really should be highlighted a little bit more and something that couples and people should be aware of.
Yeah, absolutely. Especially that next generation of people that are coming and wanting to build their families, you know, and from my experience, a lot of them have no idea that infertility is a thing, and nor is it a hot topic, because I can remember when I was in my 20s, I wasn't thinking about having children. I was thinking about my career, like I want to get established and all that. And then it kind of like, oh, like this is a thing. I had no clue. So
yeah, and I think that's a lot of people's experience. It's not something that they think about until they're ready to start about, you know, ready to start a family. And there's a lot more couples that have issues and struggles when that comes up. So
yeah. So how did you really get interested in like becoming an embryologist?
Yeah, so my background is in genetics. That's what I studied in undergrad. And really, they kind of go hand in hand in terms of, you know, there's a lot of genetic components to trying to conceive and growing a family. And over time, I just kind of had a little bit of an interest in reproductive health because of its relation to genetics. And I started to explore it more and kind of like, this is something I really think I would enjoy getting into. I kind of started on the sex education side and was like, just throughout my college experience, I'm like, oh my gosh, the lack of sex education is horrendous. And so I kind of started on that end, and that kind of got me into IVF and infertility. And I was just like, this is a fantastic topic. It's something I'm very interested in. It kind of allowed me to explore all of the interests I had in the field in general. And so I was like, well, how can I be in this field? I really had no idea what I wanted to do in undergrad. I knew what I liked and what I didn't like, but that was about it. And kind of did some Google searching and found the field of embryology. And I was like, this may be a good fit for me. And I'm kind of glad I looked into that and stuck it out. And it's been really just such a great experience. It's a very rewarding field. And I learned so much. I mean, I'm still constantly learning. It's such an evolving field that research and knowledge is forever changing. And I like that aspect of it.
Yeah, it's pretty fast. And in even just the field of reproductive medicine is one of the newest fields in the medical field, right? I mean, in some specialties, I mean, think about 1978, you know, that's really not that far, you know, ago. Like it's really rapidly changing at a really quick pace, and it's pretty neat to see the evolvement.
Yeah, it's growing. Unfortunately, it's growing exponentially, and I do see it continuing to be that way. And it is a newer type of medicine, and just all the research that comes with that. I'm excited to see where things end up.
Yeah, absolutely. So what is the training like to become an embryologist? I'm just very curious because, like I said, it's not a side that, like, as a patient, you necessarily see the background, like, and everything behind the scenes. And it always intrigued me, the training, like, what that looked like.
Yeah, this is a question I get a lot because it's so behind the scenes. And, you know, that's why I started the Instagram and TikTok accounts, is I really want patients to have that knowledge and have that understanding of what we're doing back there. But in terms of training in the U.S., really the restrictions are fairly, like, the guidelines are pretty lax, in my opinion, in terms of training. So in the U.S., CLIA 88, which is a law that went you know, into place in 1988, so it's fairly old, hasn't been updated in a long time. But it requires 24 hard science credit hours. So that's your biologies, chemistries, genetics, biochem, microbiology. So technically, if you have those credit hours, you are qualified to be a high complexity laboratory technician, which is andrology, embryology. Now, I will say most embryologists have at least a bachelor's degree. And most, you know, a lot of them even go into master's or PhD. I just have a bachelor's degree because I was burned out with school. I couldn't do anything. But really, a lot of it is on the job training. So I didn't have any prior reproductive medicine lab experience. I had my basic biology labs. I had done some research on campus, that sort of thing. But I didn't have any lab experience related to the field. So really, I came in as a junior andrologist, which andrology, we are, you know, looking at sperm, oftentimes doing hormone testing and things like that, running blood machines. And I kind of trained my way into embryology, which is, I know the career path of a lot of embryologists, because the only way you get that experience is by doing it. There aren't really a whole lot of, like, universities that once you finish their program that you can jump right into an embryology lab, like, that they don't really exist at this point. I know there are some that are working towards that, but at this point, a lot of them are, a lot of embryologists have been trained on the job. So, as I, you know, went along, I added more techniques and more procedures. And it can take a long time because the embryologists who are above you, who are training you, they have to do their full workload, along with also trying to train. So I'd have to, like, do my work and then, like, try to get back there to do some training, or hope someone would be willing to stay after work to kind of help me with something. So it can take a long time, and I am happy to see that the field is kind of evolving into offering more training programs and things like that, because I think they're really beneficial, especially with the demand, being so high for embryologists at this point.
Yeah, absolutely. So it pretty much is on the job training.
Yeah.
Is what you do, like, to get into it and stuff. I mean, you have, like, your core classes, but then it's almost like, like on the job training.
On the job, yeah. And I think that scares a lot of patients because it makes it sound like we're, like, training on their case, but that is not the case. We have a lot of different ways we can train without working on patient cases. So a lot of times patients will donate embryos once their family is complete, and so we're able to train on those. We can also buy mouse embryos and mouse eggs to be able to train without having to, you know, work on a patient case directly.
So have you had, like, experience of, like, so if somebody gives, like, a sperm sample and then, like, you look at the count, right, and the volume and stuff like that, do you do stuff like that, like, as an embryo? You do? Okay.
So I do on occasion. So I will say, a lot of times, once embryologists are fully trained, sometimes they don't go back to andrology, which is what sperm testing is. I've always been the type that if there's a need, wherever there's a need, like, I get paid the same.
Right, yeah.
I'm working in the embryology lab or the andrology lab. So if there's a really busy day and they need some help, I have no problem jumping in there. But I did andrology for a long time, about 2 years, almost as long as I've done embryology at this point. But I really did enjoy andrology. I think it's a fun part of the field that doesn't get a lot of attention.
So how do you get the count? Because I would imagine you're not counting every little, what? Because if you think about how many millions, right? Or, depending on the sample, right? Like, what goes into like the count? Like, and how does that get done?
Absolutely. So this was one of the first like videos that I had that like went viral because people were very like, oh my gosh, how do you do that? So it depends a little bit on the clinic and how they like to have it set up, but we are hand counting the sperm. But what we do is we put, we try to mix up the sample as much as we can, and then we're putting, 2 microliters or so, which is like a drop, onto a slide. And looking at it under the microscope, and in the microscope eyepiece, there is a grid. It's a 10 by 10 grid, 100 squares. And we are able to count like a certain amount of rows and then apply those calculations to a whole sample. So we're taking a count that gives us the concentration and motility, and then we can take into account the volume to be able to get an overall estimate of the amount of sperm in a sample. And that's something I like to highlight. It is an estimate. There's no way, like you said, for us to count every single sperm.
Absolutely. So one of the other questions too is a lot of men will sometimes have to use ICSI, and I know that that's a newer technique, but to basically inject it. How is training for that? Like, and two, how hard is that to do, to like grab one sperm, inject it, like, or even just how do you pick it? Like, how do you pick the one that is going to be the
Right.
one?
Yeah. First off, we process the sperm because we want to get that sperm out of the ejaculate because semen and sperm are two different things. Semen includes all of the other fluids and round cells and things like that. So we want to isolate the best sperm so that way we can already kind of, get out the sperm that we know for sure isn't moving or that sort of thing. And that process is using sperm wash media, which is just like a pinkish colored liquid, has lots of nutrients and proteins and things that the sperm needs. And we wash it and spin it down, and we're able to isolate just the motile sperm. And so at that point, really, the sperm swim very fast. So in terms of catching them, we actually put them in what we call a PVP, which is kind of a thicker matrix that slows down the sperm because if they're going too fast, we really can't catch them. There's no way. I've seen embryologists do it. It's very difficult. So we put them in that media to slow them down. It also allows us to look at the shape of the sperm, how the sperm is swimming, and that allows us to catch the sperm very easy. And another thing I like to mention is that morphology doesn't necessarily indicate better quality in terms of DNA, fragmentation and things like that, because the sperm head and rest of the body can look normal but still have abnormal DNA. So we try to choose the best looking sperm, but that doesn't always equate to the best quality DNA.
Yeah, that's really good to know too, because I think like there's a lot of times where you look at morphology and your morphology may be, a little bit abnormal and stuff, but maybe have a normal count, like, so yeah, that's definitely interesting because I think we all think that morphology is like, oh, if it doesn't look a certain way, like it means it's not any good. And it's not always the case,
Exactly. And the way that I think about morphology, which is something that one of the physicians I used to work with used to kind of mention, is morphology is we're much more concerned about it when patients are doing home intercourse or potentially IUI, because that is giving us a better indication of how well the sperm can swim. With home intercourse and IUI, the sperm has to swim to where it needs to go. With ICSI and even sometimes conventional insemination, they're right there at each other. We're injecting it or it's right there at the egg. So that morphology, the sperm doesn't have to work as hard to get where it needs to go. And so morphology is much more of a focus when patients are doing IUI and home intercourse. that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So like with ICSI, like you grab the sperm, right? And then you inject it. And I know I've seen like the videos, right, of them just basically putting in it, right? How difficult is it to actually do that procedure?
Personally, I find ICSI more difficult, one of the more difficult procedures. I find it more difficult than embryo biopsy because the embryo is much bigger than the sperm and things like that.
Yeah.
Really, when you're training on doing ICSI, the first thing you learn is how to use the manipulators because, you know, we're at this big microscope. I don't know if you've ever seen the setup. I think I have some videos or pictures of it on my page. Yeah. Essentially, we have these kind of joysticks that move these really tiny needles that are in the dish. And so really, the first thing you have to learn is how to set up those needles. How do you move the manipulators, making sure they're at the right angle? Because if they're not at the right angle, you can't, you're not at the right plane of the sperm because it's all 3D. So that part really was the hardest for me, is figuring out how to get the needle on right and getting the right angle and using the manipulators. And once you've got that down, you start practicing picking up sperm. So after, you know, a senior embryologist was done, I'd say, hey, can you leave your needles up? And I would practice just, you know, we have to immobilize the sperm tails. You may have seen videos of it. We kind of strike the tails to get them to stop moving. And that doesn't kill the sperm, but that process is required to allow some of the enzymes and other proteins that the sperm has to be released, which helps with fertilization. And so in natural fertilization, the sperm stop moving once they've started to get into the egg. So we practice that because you have to know how to go up and down to be able to strike the tail. You have to be able to catch the sperm and move them, you know, move the tails in a way that you can strike them. And then the other piece of that process is using the injector, which I actually have right here, a little mini one that I take with me when I travel. And that is part of the process that allows us to suck up the sperm. So this is basically like a little suction. So we use this to suck in and out. This is holding the ICSI needle. And so we have to be able to learn how to use this to be able to suck up the sperm appropriately. We don't want to suck up, you know, too much media between each sperm. There have been times where I've like blown out a bunch of media and bubbles, and then your dish is all full of bubbles and things like that. And really the injection part I find the easiest because you've got your sperm, they're ready, you know, manipulating the egg on the other holding pipette, which is the other needle. That part can be a little bit difficult because it's 3D. And then practicing injecting, making sure that needle gets in the right location, that you are in the center of the egg because it's 3D. We don't want to be at the top or the bottom of the egg. And then just having the right suction so that you're not, you know, blowing more than one sperm in there or too much media and things like that can damage the egg. So I personally find it one of the more difficult procedures to learn, but someone else may think something different. In terms of my experience, it's been one of the more difficult.
See, I would think just the manipulation itself, and maybe it's something that you do or do not think about, but I'm just thinking like, if this is somebody's embryo, I would be very nervous and my hands probably would be shaking, like trying to like manipulate that, like, and like doing like the, like just the right amount. That's where I think it would seem really difficult.
There's definitely some pressure that comes, and really as you train, that pressure kind of melts away a little bit because there is a level of confidence that you have going into the lab. Yeah. And there are some people I've met, embryologists that I've met, that are like, hey, I am not confident in this skill. And they may decide to stay in andrology. There are career andrologists who are like, I just don't like the pressure back there. I don't like the feeling back there. And they stay back there. And that's a perfectly wonderful career as well. But it definitely takes some confidence. And that's why there's so much training involved before you actually work on patient cases. Because that first time you work on a patient case, you have injected hundreds of eggs and it's still nerve wracking. You're like, I've done this so many times that I'm like, this is the real deal. This is what it comes down to, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I can imagine the pressure being immense, especially, I mean, you're in the field for a reason and wanting to see that success. And even though like, there's only so much you can do around that, you know, like you have to let nature kind of take its course. But I would imagine, like I said, the pressure of wanting to see this be successful.
And knowing that you had some sort of part in it.
Right.
You know, and you could potentially change the course of how things go. It can be very intimidating for sure.
Yeah. So when you're in embryology, like lab portion, what does a typical day look like for you?
Yeah. So most labs, you're starting quite early in the morning. 7 o'clock is usually about, from my experience, most labs are starting about 7 o'clock.
Okay.
The first thing you have to do is QC, which is quality control, meaning that we are measuring the levels of everything, the temperature in the lab, the temperature in all the incubators, gas levels, humidity levels, air pressure, you know, media pH, all of those things have to be done before we start anything, because we want to make sure that all of our equipment is working properly. If there's anything out of range, we're saying, hey, you know, what's up with this? Do we need to mitigate? Should we check it again? And that usually takes, depending on the lab, anywhere from 10 to 30 minutes. If they've got 15 incubators, it takes a lot longer.
Well, right. Yeah.
And then at that point, I'm looking to see what we have on the schedule. Every day is a little bit different. I may have timed procedures, meaning that I have to be ready for an egg retrieval at this time or transfer at this time. And then there are some days where we don't have any timed procedures. It's just in-lab procedures. So we have biopsy or we have embryo vit, which is kind of on our time, if that makes sense. We can kind of do whatever we want throughout the day. And usually most days it's a combination of those things. So we have some time procedures, we have some procedures that we can do on our own time. And we're kind of working out when we're gonna do each of those things. And then usually by lunchtime, we've kind of finished up with any sort of retrievals. And we're kind of, we may start setting up for the next day. And we're kind of finishing up morning things, which are like FERT check we do in the morning. Usually if we have patients who have embryos for transfer, those are oftentimes in the morning, that sort of thing. And then in the afternoon is, this is my typical schedule. Some other
different,
but in the afternoon is when I like to do biopsy. I like to do biopsy in the afternoon. I like to do setup for the next day in the afternoon. Paperwork, all of that comes into play. And really, the paperwork takes longer than anything else. Setting up for procedures and paperwork oftentimes takes longer than doing the actual procedure.
Yeah, I can relate to that. Like, especially in being in the field of social work, the paperwork is what takes you longer, like the actual doing a thing, you know.
Yeah.
Paperwork's always been.
The paperwork is always the longest thing, and nobody likes to do it. And if you're lucky enough, there are some labs that have embryology assistants, which I have only been to one lab that had one. It was awesome. Like, they did all the paperwork, they did all the setup. I was like, what is this? This is fantastic.
Yeah. One last thing for you to have to worry about. Yeah.
Exactly.
So when you're doing a transfer, like, and you thought, and it comes from a frozen embryo, what is that like? Like, how far in advance are you thawing the embryo? And I remember with my wife and I, when we did the transfer, and the embryologist brought in like the device and stuff with embryo in it. So I would love to know, I'm sure many others would, like, what is that procedure like up to that point?
Absolutely. So that's another thing that we do in the morning. So we thaw embryos. That's usually, if we have FETs, that's the first thing I'm doing in the morning, is prepping paperwork and getting ready to thaw those. We like to thaw them typically a few hours before the actual transfer. That's a clinic by clinic thing. Some say 2 hours, some say 3 hours, some say an hour. It kind of depends on what the clinic's preference is, and the like maturity of the embryo. If it's an earlier embryo, we may thaw it earlier in the day, sort of thing.
Okay.
But usually I am setting up for FETs first thing in the morning. We have media that we want to pull out, which is thaw media. Some of it has to be at room temperature. Some of it has to be at 37 degrees. So some embryologists will pull that out the night before to make sure it's got plenty of time. Some will pull it first thing in the morning, depending on how long their QC is.
Okay.
Once that's pulled out, we are looking at the lab order, and that is our Bible. That is what we go by. It tells us who's getting what, if there's a specific sex that they want or a specific embryo that's to be thawed, we are going by that and referencing that to the patient's chart, which will have all their embryo information, you know, any sort of genetic testing. And we are then pulling out their cane that has their embryos in it, which are frozen on little straws. But that information has to be verified by another person. You know, we want to make sure that we have selected the correct embryo. It matches the patient record. You know, we have someone verify that and you're signing your initials to it because we don't want to have any mistakes here.
Right.
And then at that point, we are prepping our dishes with the thaw media. So really, the process of thawing the embryo takes only about 10 minutes. It's very fast.
Okay.
We are moving the embryo from the liquid nitrogen into a different series of media. So it's in the first media for a minute, and then we're moving it into different types of media. And really, the media just has less and less sucrose or type of sugar, depending on the type of media you're using. So when you move it from the liquid nitrogen to the first media, it's the highest level of sugar, and then it kind of slowly goes down from there. And then at that point, we are moving the embryo into a culture dish, which is media that has been gassed out overnight. That is media that needs to be equilibrated with different gases versus ambient air media that doesn't need the pH balance. And then it usually sits in that dish until we're ready for transfer. Usually we'll take it out for a picture to verify that it is still living. Usually within the first 30 minutes of thawing an embryo, we know whether it's going to survive or not. Thaw survival rates are very high for most clinics, but it does happen here and there. So we do like to check it. At that point, depending on the lab, the physician will come in and verify some things, or we're going in and talking to the patient and saying, this is what we thawed. Sometimes they want to know the sex, sometimes they don't. Sometimes they're untested. Yeah. We don't know either. And we're verifying, this is the embryo that we thawed. You know, we thawed one or we thawed two. I want you to verify your name for me. And we may even have them verify a dish. I've been at labs that has a camera, so I can put it under the microscope and they can see what I'm doing.
Yeah.
And then you or your partner has a very full bladder, I'm sure.
Yeah.
And they're waiting for us to load that embryo into the catheter. We're waiting to hear the okay from the physician that they have their trial catheter in the place that they want it. And then we're ready to load up that embryo and bring it in. Sometimes we'll pass it in to the physician. Sometimes we'll walk it in and thread it ourselves. That's kind of dependent on the clinic.
Yeah.
And then once we've, you know, injected the embryo, we can't see that. I know on the ultrasound, you may see kind of a shooting star or a little flash of media. And that gives us a good indication that the embryo has gotten out of the catheter, but we always check it just to make sure. Every once in a while, an embryo will get stuck in there. They can be kind of sticky sometimes.
Yeah.
We always flush that catheter with media to make sure that the embryo has gotten where it's supposed to be. But that's kind of the day there in terms of an embryo transfer.
Yeah. So there's a lot of steps to really get to that point, you know, like, even though like it may not take that long, but it just seems like I know, like I would have forgotten the step after step two or three, you know, like, but I think once you get probably in the routine of it, it's probably just routine, you know?
Yeah. I was going to say it becomes very routine, but it's interesting from I love to always hear the patient's perspective because I don't see that perspective a lot.
Yeah.
So for them, it's like they come in with a full bladder and the embryo is ready. But, you know, we've spent hours kind of on the back end getting things ready for them.
Yeah. Yeah. That's awesome.
Yeah. It's one of my most favorite things to do because generally it's a more happy occasion to see patients and they're very excited and they've waited a really long time to get to this point oftentimes.
Yeah.
So it's usually a happy day in the lab.
Yeah, absolutely. So I was actually talking to my wife the other day and I was just like, okay, I'm like, I have at least the embryologist on today. And I'm like trying to think of questions and stuff. And one of the questions that she wanted answered was, how much does the grading of the embryo matter? Because on social media, and she's on different Facebook groups and stuff, and there's a lot of talk about how the grading is more of a beauty contest rather than it meaning, like, you know, genetically, you know. So she was just like, I would just like to know for sure, like, how much does grading really make a difference or matter?
Yeah, this is by far my number one asked question. I get this question like once a day sort of thing, because there's a lot of like mystery behind this embryo grading and there are a couple different perspectives. But I think in general, really when patients' embryos are PGTA tested, it's not that the grade isn't important. but we're not as concerned about it because the grade does not indicate your chance of getting pregnant. It doesn't indicate genetic normalcy. So you can have a low quality graded embryo that makes a beautiful baby that's genetically normal. And you can have a very highly graded embryo that is genetically abnormal or won't implant. And so we can't correlate grade to chance of success in terms of pregnancy rates, and we can't correlate it to genetic normalcy. And I think those are some misconceptions that patients have about grading.
Okay. So then, like, with the,
well,
like,
the next question is, then why do it?
Right. Like, that's exactly. I was just like, then what, you know, what is the meaning behind it then?
Yeah. Yeah. So really, it's from an embryologist perspective. When I'm looking at the quality of an embryo, I'm looking at a couple things. I'm looking at the ICM, I'm looking at the trophectoderm, but I'm also thinking about everything we have to put it through. Really, the culture process isn't the least stressful thing that an embryo has to go through. It's fairly stressful on the cells, on the environment of the embryo, all of those things. If we're doing biopsy, if we're freezing, anytime we're manipulating it, that's added stress to the embryo. So really, when I'm looking at a poor quality embryo, I'm thinking, does this have enough cells for me to take from it if we're doing biopsy? Are these cells hardy enough that I think it will survive the freezing process, the thawing process, the manipulation we have to put it through, having it go from in and out of the incubator a couple times, all of those things. So that's why you know, we grade embryos, and that's where I think that embryo grading comes into play. And again, this is my, based on my experience, but I would think other embryologists would kind of agree on that perspective. But biopsy in particular, we are taking anywhere between 5 to 10 cells of an embryo. And a good quality embryo has 100 to 150 cells. But a poor quality embryo may have 25 to 50. And so taking 5 to 10 cells of an embryo that has 50 cells is very different from taking 5 to 10 cells from an embryo that has 100 cells. So that's kind of where that grading comes into play. We want to make sure it's going to survive all of the stresses that we're putting it through.
Okay. That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. And so that's why it's not that they don't make babies. It's that we have to be okay with them going through all those things. And that's why we still pick the highest quality embryo, even though that one doesn't necessarily have more of a chance than a lower quality embryo. It's because we know this one has a lot more cells and will survive better.
Yeah. So when you're freezing an embryo, because especially when people do like an egg retrieval, I know, like, for my wife and I, we did like 4 rounds of egg banking, and then like we fertilized, and I think we ended up with 7 like embryos, which 2 of them were euploid, and then some of them were a little mosaic and all that. But when you're watching them, right, because it's the clinic we used did a 5-day, like a 5-day blastocyst, and then froze them. So what's the freezing process? Because I know it's not like, oh, I'm just going to put it in the freezer, right? You know, like, you have to slowly do it, right? I mean, because I remember reading about, like, you don't want, like, crystals to formulate and all that kind of stuff. So
exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So freezing techniques and media has gotten so much better. And that is the goal, just what you said. We want to minimize the chance of an ice crystal forming in the embryo, because ice expands and things, and that's where the cell damage happens. So really, the freezing process is almost the opposite of the thawing process. We are slowly introducing higher concentrations of sugar, because due to osmosis and polarity, the embryo will, I'm trying to think of the best way to explain it, shrivel up. It's releasing all of the fluid, as much fluid as it can, because fluid freezes and has a chance of forming ice crystals. Right. So really, we want to get the embryo to get rid of as much fluid as it can. It kind of shrivels up into a ball, and that allows us to replace some of that fluid with cryoprotectant media that doesn't form ice crystals. And really, it's a rapid vitrification, not freezing. So that terminology has changed. And I think a lot of embryologists, even me, still use the term freezing, but freezing implies in a technical protocol perspective, slow freezing, which is much different than what we do now, which is rapid vitrification. Once that embryo has gone through the media steps, it goes right into liquid nitrogen and it freezes immediately. Versus kind of older techniques that is frozen in a vial and then you bring it down to this temperature, then you bring it down to this temperature, and then you put it in liquid nitrogen. The freezing process now has gotten much better. I should say the vitrification process, because that's what it is. It's rapid vitrification. But that's kind of the process there. And you're right on when you're talking about the ice crystals. That is the goal.
Yeah. This is maybe a little bit off topic, but I've always been interested in this. And a lot of times, like younger women, like, or, you know, what women that have had cancer, right? I mean, they're telling you to freeze your eggs. Now, I know like the science behind it, the thawing of the eggs is not as conducive, I guess. Like, it doesn't guarantee that those eggs are going to be right. As an embryologist, like, what is the difficulty like in thawing the eggs compared to like sperm? Because that's been shown.
Yes.
I know that there's that debate, right? Of like, okay, should we tell people or tell women, you know, you need to freeze their eggs, but realistically, how many of them don't make the thaw?
Right.
Thoughts on that. Yeah.
That's a great point, because embryo survival rates post thaw are much higher than egg survival rates post-thaw. And they've gotten closer. They have gotten, like I said, they've gotten better and better, and they're almost there. But the hardest thing with eggs, it's one cell. We are freezing one cell versus an embryo that has 100 cells. And even with the embryo freezing and thawing process, we're losing a couple cells here and there. We expect, you know, a small percentage of cells to not make it through that process. Mm-hmm. And so when we have eggs, if you think of, you know, 10 eggs, almost like you're thinking of a whole embryo, if we expect to lose 1-2% of cells in an embryo, we're expecting to lose 1-2% of eggs in the process, because it's one cell. But I will say things have gotten much better, especially with the cryobanks that are, you know, California Cryobank, who are freezing eggs every day. They have gotten the process down to a science. They know I've done some training with them, and they're taking into account your region and whether, you know, if you're up north and it's very dry versus Florida versus, you know, your air quality, and all these things are coming into play because they're so delicate. And I remember the first time I froze practice eggs and I thawed them and they didn't survive. I was like very surprised because it's the same process. It's the same media. It's the same thing you're walking through. It's these tiny little things that you have to make adjustments on in terms of your technique to make sure that they survive. So really the biggest reason why so many of them in terms of eggs don't survive is that they're one cell and they're very delicate, and egg quality does come into play. So that's why patients who are a little bit older who are considering egg freezing, we may also talk to them about embryo freezing just because they're a little bit more hardy. And egg quality does decrease with age, as I'm sure you know.
Yeah, for sure. I don't think I have, I could probably go on for probably all day.
And that's how I am. Like, I could go on forever and ever talking about all this stuff.
Right, absolutely. I really appreciate you taking the time to help provide this understanding. And like I said, the content you put out there is phenomenal. Like, it's always interesting in looking at, like I said, like as a patient, you know, and somebody's gone through IVF, we don't see that. We don't even go back there. We just, you know, we see the rooms. That's about it. You know, like, and it's fascinating. Like, it's really amazing what all the embryologists, like all there in the clinic that are doing this. It's really, I mean, a high pressured job in some aspects. And I just to say, I appreciate everything that you and every other embryologist out there that are doing, because it's great what you guys can do with this.
Yeah. Well, thank you. It really, I have yet to meet an embryologist, one that isn't just amazed at what we do every day. Honestly, if I think too much about it, I'm like, oh my gosh, like I made that baby. Like, that's so crazy. And the other thing is, they love their jobs. We love our jobs. We really do. I have rarely come across an embryologist that doesn't enjoy what they do every day and feel very fulfilled with what they do.
Yeah.
We appreciate the recognition when we get it, but we really enjoy it. And my goal with everything that I do on social media is really to give patients the knowledge that they don't typically get from their clinic, and give them knowledge. That knowledge allows them to make more and better informed decisions about their care, because really have a full picture understanding of what we're doing and a little bit of the science behind it. It allows you to make a better decision, a more informed decision. And really, that's the goal. We want patients to understand what they're doing. They're spending a lot of time. They're spending a lot of money on these procedures. And most of it is lab, because it's expensive to run a lab. And we want to make sure that they understand, the process. And that was kind of my goal with everything, and to give them some peace of mind, because I know it's scary to be like, all of our stuff is in there and we have no idea what's happening.
For sure.
The waiting, I know, is the hardest part. So if you have an idea of like, okay, the embryologist is doing this today, it may give you a little bit more peace of mind in the process.
Yeah, absolutely. I have one last question.
Yeah, go for it.
I'm always about providing education for the next generation. And one of my previous guests, Dr. Carolyn Alexander, would often go to sororities, and when I say that, she went to med school at UCLA, I think, or no, John Hopkins, but I think she's pre-med at UCLA. But she would go to sororities and provide fertility awareness with how do you preserve your fertility, right? I'm just thinking about biology, right? This is not talked about in a biology course at a university.
Nope.
And how great would it be to speak about this, of hey, this is a career path, you may not be interested in now, but if they don't know about it, how are they going to maybe be interested?
I think that's so important. And really, I didn't think about this when I started my page, because it was geared towards patient education.
Yeah.
But the amount of students that have now come to me and said, oh my gosh, I didn't even know this was a career. This sounds so cool. Can you talk to me more about it? How'd you get into it? What do you have to, when you Google how to become an embryologist, you're not going to find anything super relevant.
Right.
I had a meeting with a student the other day, because she was like, I'm interested in this and I want to know more. And I really think it's really important to educate not only about the career, but educating about the career also in turn educates about fertility in general.
Right.
So that's also a big push of mine. I went to NC State.
Okay.
T-shirt on.
Nice.
And I have worked a lot with them, with their genetics department, and I'd love to put together some sort of embryology course with them that kind of goes over some of these things, and like I said, not only for the future of the career, but for the future of fertility in general and reproductive health awareness. I think it's very important. So anytime, I love that the physician goes and talks to sororities. I think that's great.
Yeah, I like I said, I think about all the aspects of IVF, genetics and biology, and then you have, the mental health side of it, then you have the medical side. There's so many different fields that go into this, and to me, it's the more education, the better, because the likelihood that one of them is going to know somebody that is struggling with infertility is likely, it's high. Yeah. Or they themselves may end up having to kind of go through that journey. And even though they, at that point in their 20s, they're not thinking about it, it's still something that they should be learning about.
Right. And that way, when it comes, they may not ever need that information for themselves, but I really believe it will come up in some context at some point. And they've got, got that background. Hey, I remember that class I took, they were talking about this. Maybe you should look into this or talk to this person. And, I unfortunately see the field only growing. And so it's important to make young people aware of the field for their own personal reproductive journey or for their career path.
Yeah, absolutely.
There's so many ways to get into it. It doesn't have to be science. I talked to someone the other day. They're like, I want to get into the field, but I only have this degree. I'm like, we need financial coordinators. We need, medical health professionals. We need lawyers and, staff. And we need, it's everywhere. Everywhere.
Yeah. Yeah. There are so many different avenues that you can get involved. with this. And like I said, it's a neat field because it's ever changing. You know, like you're always trying to keep up with the most research, and even when you have it, you're gonna find some curveball, and they're like, I never saw this before. You know, like
Exactly.
do this. You know, like it's always learning. You know, like and adjusting and stuff. And yeah.
And I think that's the hardest thing for, I know this is not necessarily on topic, but this is the hardest thing for, I think, professionals in the field is when patients come to us and they're like, well, why did this happen? Or what's going on with this? And we're like, this is something I've never seen. And it's hard to give a patient the answer, I don't know, you know, because there is so much of it that's still so new and still being researched. And we want to give patients those answers because it gives them peace of mind. Well, this is why that happened. And sometimes we don't know. And that's the hardest thing when I'm on the phone with a patient to be like, this is what we saw, but we don't really know why that happened. We don't really know how to fix it. It's something that's still being explored. And you know, that I'm sure as a patient on that side, it's hard to hear that information. You know, it's hard to hear
Yeah, especially the ambiguity of it. You're trying to make some sort of meaning, and you're left with your own what ifs, and then a lot of times those what ifs you go down a really dark rabbit hole, you know. So, well, Lisa, I really appreciate the time that you took out to educate all of us, you know, on kind of the behind the scenes look. And yeah, I look forward to seeing what you do more in the future. And yeah, thanks for being on here.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. It's been a great conversation. Like I said, I love what you're doing and showing the, you know, the male partner, the support partner kind of aspect. And I love what you're doing. It's definitely needed and not talked about enough. So keep doing what you're doing. And anytime you need anything from me, don't hesitate to reach out. And I appreciate you inviting me on.
Awesome. All right. Yeah, I appreciate that. And yeah, thanks.
Yeah.
Thank you for listening to the Miles Podcast. The Miles Podcast is on Apple, Google, Spotify, Stitcher, and Overcast. If you could like, rate, subscribe, and share the podcast to help other men or other couples find it, it'd be greatly appreciated. Be sure to follow me on Instagram and Twitter for updates on future episodes and more content related to infertility and family building. As always, if you'd like to be a guest, please message me on my social media or email at themilespodcast@gmail.com, and I hope that you will continue this miles-long journey with me.